Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. My guest is Ciriaco Acta from the Philippines. He writes for the Alternative Right. First of all, it's nice having you back on the show.
Great to be back.
When I had you on earlier, one of the things we talked about was this article you wrote about the new right. And it's called The New Right and What It Has to Offer the Rest of the World. And that was posted up on this site, Countercurrents. I think we did discuss that extensively, but if you want to sort of bring that up briefly, I think it's worth discussing.
Yeah, okay. The New Right and what it could offer the rest of the world was basically my first article on the alternative right. And my purpose in writing that was basically to create a sort of a right-wing version of the anti-globalist movement, because the vast majority of the anti-globalist movement is basically slanted towards the left wing. So I wanted people to know about the right-wing version of anti-globalism, of anti-modernism, and that sort of thing. And that's basically the premise of that article.
And you were referring specifically to the new right?
Yeah. When I say the new right, I'm not speaking specifically about the European new right. I'm referring to a broader definition of the new right in the US as well as in Europe and also in Russia, you know, guys like Dugin and the Euro-Siberian movement, where they basically take the anti-modernism of the past and mix it up with Nietzsche and the manosphere and human biodiversity and various aspects of paleoconservatism and sort of create a new synthesis of right-wing anti-globalism. That, for me, that's how I define the new right, basically.
And what does it have to offer the rest of the world outside of the West and the developed world?
It basically gives it an alternative to the left-wing anti-globalist movement. If you follow the anti-globalist movement back in 2001, most of their positions were based around the idea that globalism was basically a new form of colonialism. And for me, Let me put it this way. Anti-globalism of the left has a particular narrative that is rooted in the anti-colonialist movements in the earlier parts of the 20th century. So what interested me about the new right is that it offers a fresh perspective with regards to anti-modernism, anti-globalism, and also because I believe that the ideas of the left with regard to egalitarianism, political correctness, that sort of thing is just not compatible with the rest of the world. The ideas of the new right, particularly the European new right, and also Dugin, who formulated the multipolar theory, their ideas are more compatible with traditional non-white culture rather than the egalitarianism and the progressivism of the left.
And you've also said economics also tie in with this.
Yeah. Obviously, because I consider that there's no such thing as economies. There's just one giant global economy, and everything is tied up there. You know, some people will say that China is a communist state, and the U.S. is a capitalist state, but those distinctions are relevant now. They're both global economies. And the economic ideas being proposed by sites like Countercurrents and some of the thinkers in the European New Right and the Euro-Siberian movements like Dugin is that it's basically an economy that is no longer globalist. Not in the sense that I'm not necessarily a distributist or a follower of social credit, although those ideas are very good, but the values they represent are anti-globalist. Their worldview is not obsessed with the idea of more and more growth, more and more consumption, more and more fast cars and fancy gadgets. And basically, it's something more sustainable. And that's the economic value of the ideas of the new right, as I see it.
Do you see those ideas as being viable in other parts of the world? You mentioned that people in countries like yours, a lot of them are interested in the economic opportunities that globalization offers.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people are interested in the wealth that globalism offers. A lot of countries in the developing areas of the world will say that they oppose globalism. But they only oppose those aspects of globalism that are in opposition to their interests. They don't actually oppose it in its entirety. Of course, there are a lot of people who are quite honest about their opposition to globalism. They will oppose it in its entirety. But there are some people who will only oppose those aspects of globalization that they perceive to be opposed to their interests. Now, the importance of economic ideas like distributism, social credit, if you're inclined towards anarchism, mutualism, and syndicalism, is that they offer alternatives. And the most important thing at this point is to offer people alternatives, even if those alternatives are not perfected yet. They must be brought to the table so that people will accept the idea that their options are not just A and B, but there are many other options that they can try.
So I'm looking over your articles at Alternative Right. Your more recent one is on democracy, but I think this one on colonialism is more relevant to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And it's called Rethinking Colonialism, Moving Beyond a Narrow Victimology.
Okay, so I'll just give a brief summary of that. Whenever people speak about colonialism, it's usually on a very specific way. When they say colonialism, it's usually European colonialism that they're referring to. Now, let me just be clear on this. I'm not saying that European colonialism was good or evil or any of that thing. It was a specific event in human history. It caused a lot of pain and misery, but in another sense, it also created a lot of wonderful things for the entire world. For example, here in the Philippines, Spanish colonialism improved agriculture. It opened trade. It created roads. But at the same time, it disrupted our traditional lifestyle. So there's some good and there's some evil in European colonialism. Now, my opinion is rather irrelevant about that. What is relevant is that when people talk about colonialism, they see it in a very specific way, as in it's evil, and the people who perpetrate European colonialism, i.e. Europeans, are evil. So, for example, mass immigration into Europe. A liberal, a leftist will say, well, they're justified to that because European colonialism was evil and blah, blah, blah. Europeans deserve to be colonialized. So it's basically that kind of narrative. Now, I took that narrative and I tried to put another perspective on that. And my perspective on that is that colonialism is a lot more complicated than just economic exploitation. And the way I presented that is that colonialism is not exclusive Europeans. A lot of other people perpetrated colonialism. The Turks did it. The Moors did it. The Incas practiced a sort of internal colonialism in what is today Latin America. The Chinese colonized Vietnam 4 times. The Japanese colonized parts of Manchuria prior to World War II. So I'm trying to expand the definition of colonialism beyond the leftist definition that, oh, you know, colonialism was perpetrated by Europeans. So I wanted to expand beyond that. And after I expanded beyond that, what I wanted to point out is that the distinction between European colonialism and other forms of colonialism, the colonialisms perpetrated by non-whites in the past. And I quoted Eric Hoffer, who is an American social writer, on one of his works, The True Believer. Eric Hoffer writes in The True Believer, "The discontent generated in backward countries by their contact with Western civilization is not primarily resentment against exploitation by domineering foreigners. It is rather the result of a crumbling or weakening tribal solidarity and communal life." So Eric Hoffer is very politically incorrect, but he has a point. He has a point. And I tried to expand on that by pointing out that the difference between European colonialism, the type of colonialism carried out by the Spanish, the British, the Dutch, the French, and the colonialism perpetrated by guys like Genghis Khan, Timur the Lame, the Moors, the Turks, the Chinese, etc., is that European colonialism, unlike other forms of colonialism, created modernity. Basically, European colonialism, the moment it expanded into the other parts of the world, rendered the cultures of other parts of the world obsolete.
You talk about the narrative of the left that colonialism is responsible for all the poverty in the third world. And you give some examples of, you give the examples of Hong Kong, Singapore, Macau,
yeah,
and a lot of the wealth that the Panama and the Suez canals bring into the to Panama and Egypt.
Yeah. And basically what I'm trying to point out is that the narrative of the left with regards to colonialism is they're right about something, but they're not right about what they think they're right about. They point out that it's because of economic exploitation. Well, the third world is not poor because of economic exploitation.
So you're saying they're mainly right in the sense that they impose their culture on those people, but their idea that the poverty there today is a product of past colonialism is false.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, if colonialism leads to poverty, Hong Kong would be a garbage dump right now, but it's not. The same with Singapore. The same with Manila. Manila was the center of colonialism here in the Philippines, and it's the most developed part of the Philippines. But colonialism created another problem in that it rendered the culture, the metaphysics, the epistemology of non-white culture obsolete. You know, let me put it this way. Imagine a small island and still living in what would be basically the Middle Ages. They have agriculture, but they're extremely poor. And suddenly, one day, a ship full of white people, a modern ship, lands on that island and gives them medicine, gives them electricity, gives them everything we take for granted in the modern world. And the moment they do that, their culture basically becomes obsolete. So when colonialism happened, it wasn't just economic exploitation, because the left are obsessed with economics. They see everything in materialistic terms. They don't see the deeper problems of the world beyond how much money and how much wealth and how much technology a particular place has. What they fail to understand is that colonialism created a whole system wherein everyone has no choice but to go towards one direction. So to me, colonialism is a forerunner of globalism, because the moment everything became obsolete, Chinese Confucian ideas towards society is now obsolete. Japanese aren't going to go back to being samurai. And here in the Philippines, we're not going to go back to how we were before the Spanish found us. The only people resisting globalism at the moment are the Islamists, and they're not doing a very good job at it either. So what you have to understand is that from our perspective, we're all traveling down one road, and we didn't create that road. The Europeans did. So that's one of the problems of colonialism, as I see it, a problem that has led to modernity.
So that's the thing about it. Globalism, you see there's the economic side of it, and then there's a cultural side.
Yeah.
And you think, because of what the leftists say mostly is that globalism is economically exploiting people in these third world countries. And then on the other side, there's people who are more on the nationalist side. People talk about how all those jobs are going overseas, like the call center jobs going to India and the manufacturing jobs going to China. And the focus, there's an economic focus of on those two arguments.
Yeah. But the cultural side of it is that all other cultures are now dying, basically. When you look at China, China is not asserting Confucian values. China is trying to catch up with America, basically. Same with India. They're trying to be more American than American. They're more trying to be more Western than Westerners. And we have to remember that basically back in the 20th century, the idea of development was synonymous with Westernization. So the idea that there are still various cultures in the world is not quite true anymore, because everything has become obsolete. The culture of other civilizations has become obsolete. There's only modernity now. And going back to the benefits of the New Right wants to transcend modernity. It wants to go over that. But transcending the modern world is not so easy. You have to convince people that there's something more to human life than just having more cars, having a larger GDP, having better iPods and laptops and stuff like that. So, as I mentioned before, that's one of the things that's important about what the New Right is doing. It's trying to create a vision of the future that doesn't involve the values of modernity. Because I have to point out that right now, the non-whites of the entire world are trying to take over modernity. When European colonialism spread throughout the world, it spread Western culture throughout the world. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I personally think that that's a great thing, actually, that European culture was able to spread around. But when something better comes along, something must become obsolete. And in the case of the Philippines and other colonial countries, when their culture became obsolete, when the revolution came about, we didn't want to restore what was in the past. We simply took over what was already built by the European colonizers. We didn't go back to worshiping our pre-Christian gods. We simply took over what was built by the Spanish. The same with Hong Kong. The Chinese simply took over what the British built. The same in Mexico, in Panama, and various places in Latin America. They simply took over what was already built. In some cases, they were able to maintain it. They were able to make it better. And in other cases, such as in Africa, it fell apart. So you see the pattern there. You kind of see the pattern. And here in modernity, what we have to understand about modernity is that it's still a product of European colonialism. Now, some traditionalists may say, no, modernity is not a product.
Yeah, well, a lot of traditionalists will say that stuff like Walmart and McDonald's that's being imported to the other parts of the world, that's not Western culture. That's anti-culture or not a culture at all.
Yeah.
What do you say to that argument?
Well, basically, modernity is a product of liberalism, and liberalism has its roots in Western thought. Now, liberalism, I believe, when it was fresh and it was new, it had a lot of great ideas, okay? But over time, like all things, it decays, it degrades. Everything degrades. Confucianism in China became decadent over time, the same with the Hindus over time. The Hindus created a wonderful religion. It created a lot of great literature. But over time, Hindu religion also became decadent. everything decays. So modernity is a product of liberalism, but it's a twisted form of liberalism, classical liberalism, not the kind of liberal globalism that we have today. So that's basically my answer to that.
So I guess the question is, if we throw out modernity, what do we replace it with? Some people just want to go back to the past and copy everything from the past, but that's not really practical either.
No, obviously not. And the Filipino experience is proof of that. When we kicked out the Spanish, we weren't going to go back to worshiping our old idols. We liked being Christian. Many of our national heroes here believe that they were more Christian than the Spanish, in fact. So no one's really going back to the past. We have to go beyond modernity. Unfortunately, for many people, going beyond modernity is unthinkable. Some people will say, we can always go back to the past, but we can't go back to the past. You have to see, we have to go beyond that. And some people will say, well, even if modernity falls apart, Filipino culture is still alive, Chinese culture is still alive, Indian culture is still alive. No, it isn't. It's dying at this very moment because of consumerism and globalism. India and China are trying to become Western. They're trying to become more Western than the Westerners. So the idea that Chinese culture is still thriving is not quite true. What is thriving is a globalist version of Chinese culture, a globalist version of Indian culture, a globalist version of everything. That is what is thriving at the moment, not the organic, traditional, communal forms of life that were rooted in localism and self-sufficiency. So when modernity falls apart, a lot of people are going to fall apart. And this goes back to my argument in my first article about the new right, that what is happening in the Western world now could very well happen to the rest of the world given time.
Are you talking about what you said? Well, you say it's important to understand mass immigration in this context. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Yeah. And basically, mass immigration is, some people will say, oh, you know, the Jews are behind mass immigration. Well, maybe that's true up to a certain point. And other people will say that mass immigration is caused by globalist economics, which is also true. But in a wider context, mass immigration is happening because local culture is no longer as strong as it used to be. What we now have is a global culture, and that global culture is what allows mass immigration to happen. And when you look back to the colonial period, when we kicked out the Spanish, we took over what they built. What is happening now, mass immigration in the context of globalization, is similar to that. Non-whites all over the world, China, India, Brazil, what they want to do is to take over modernity. They want to be the biggest, you know, China wants to become the biggest economy. They want to become the most powerful army. They want to have the most prestige. So what they are basically trying to do is kick out the Americans, who are still perceived as a white nation. Make no mistake, for the rest of the world, America is still a white nation. And then we're taking over modernity. We're the richest. We're the most powerful. But becoming the most powerful in modernity, becoming the wealthiest in modernity, that will not solve the problems of non-whites. It will not solve the fact that culture is dying, that differentiation is dying. Look at Obama, for example. Obama became the president of the United States. Did it solve the problems of the blacks? Did it?
No, of course not.
Of course not. The idea that white people built America, and now that you have a black president, everything's fine now. Black people feel, I visit a lot of black nationalist sites, and some of them are good, some of them are not so good, just like white nationalist sites.
Do you mind listing which sites are good and which ones are not so good of both of those groups?
Well, I mostly visit the black anarchist sites. There was
Oh, the one that's affiliated with the guy that Keith Preston interviewed.
Yeah, Attack the System. I usually click their sites. I used to visit, well, I like visiting Nation of Islam, but Nation of Islam is, it's frankly a little crazy. And there was one of my past favorites was News and Views. Oh, wait. I can't remember her name right now, but she was also a contributor in the alternative right. She was a black libertarian. I can't remember all the black nationalist sites I visited, basically. But what I want to share in the context of our discussion is that some black nationalists will point out that America was built by white people. And as long as black people are not given the chance to create something on their own, they will continue to feel alienation. And that's a very good observation. Black people should be able to create something on their own, of their own. And many of them advocate a pan-secessionist position. And I like pan-secessionists. I like the anarchists. I just don't agree with everything they say, but I like them very much. I like their ideas very much. So going back to Obama, when Obama became the president of the United States, it didn't solve the problems of the blacks because blacks didn't create anything. What happened is that there's a symbol of a black guy in the White House, and that symbol is power. We've taken over. But even if you have the power, even if you have the money, the tanks, the wealth, you know, the white women's, the lack of culture is still there. The alienation is still there. And once the system collapses, once modernity collapses, you'll be left with nothing but rubble. Look at Haiti, for example. The blacks took over. They kicked out white people. Did it solve their problems? No, it didn't. In some ways, it made it worse. The same with Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. The same with South Africa. You can take over what the white guy built, but it will not solve your problems. And that's what I want to point out in my article on rethinking colonialism, basically.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll discuss the other article you have up on alternative right, Deconstructing Democracy. Welcome back. I'm here with Ciriaco Acta from the Philippines, and we're going to be discussing his most recent article at Alternative Right. It's Deconstructing a Democracy. And you focus this article is focused sort of on the history of the Philippines.
No, it's focused on...
Well, the opening, that's how you introduce it, but you talk about the issue as a whole.
Yeah. It's a review of Alain de Benoist's book, The Problem of Democracy, and I contacted John Morgan, and he was kind enough to give me a copy so I can review it, so I can spread it around. My purpose in contacting John Morgan of Arctos is to discuss the possibility if he would like to expand their operations and distribution here in the Philippines. So I said, you know, give me a few books and I'll try to see if I can get people interested. And, you know, he sent me Deconstructing Democracy, and I wrote a review for it on Alt-Right, and that's basically how it is. And I introduced the article based on the EDSA revolution. For those who in the U.S. and in Europe, EDSA is a place in Manila where the People Power Revolution took place in 1986. And I wanted to contextualize how democracy worked here in the Philippines, or more specifically, how people in the Philippines view democracy. And basically, democracy here in the Philippines is viewed nationalistically. Democracy was a product of the Philippine Revolution. As such, it is contrasted with the colonial governments of Spain and America back when they were colonizing us. So there's a certain mythical aspect to Filipino democracy because of that. It symbolizes Filipino identity and sovereignty. Right? So the very idea...
So it's not an ethno-nationalism.
Yeah, it's part ethno-nationalism, but it's also part... It has a mythical dimension to it, basically. It's not ideological in a Western sense. It's hard to define it in a specifically Western sense because Filipino politics tends to have a philosophical a poetic aspect, wherein you basically try to project political personalities in a sort of heroic or poetic light. So that's, it's hard to explain. But what I wanted to point out here is that all forms of democracy, whether they're in North Korea, America, in Europe, in the Philippines, in China, is that there's a certain level of myth involved. For example, yesterday I was involved in a debate, and two of the guys involved was an American and the other one's a European, and the European said that no, Americans don't have democracy. They just worship the rich. And the American said that no, Europeans don't have a democracy because they're too politically incorrect, they're too socialist, stuff like that. And basically you get a situation where people say, "No, I'm more democratic than you." No, I'm more democratic than you. So no one's really sure of what democracy really means. And de Benoist points that out, that in his book, that democracy has a very, very nebulous definition here in our modern day context.
So is he opposed to democracy?
I don't think so. De Benoist? No. Well, he's opposed to a certain type of democracy, our type of democracy, but I believe that de Benoist believes in reforming democracy. The last part of his book was basically giving ideas on how we can reform democracy. I think de Benoist is a populist. It would be more accurate to call him a populist.
Well, I think is what he talks about is that the problem of democracy, there's a distinction between the rule of the majority and the general will. What are the differences between those two?
The rule of majority is basically 50% plus one. The general will, on the other hand, is a little bit more difficult to define, but when you go out of your house and you see people walking about, they speak in a certain way, they laugh at certain jokes, they cry about they feel bad about certain things, and you share those things with other people. For example, I'm going to tell you a Filipino joke, and you're not likely to laugh at it. Likewise, I'm going to tell Filipinos an American joke, and they're not going to laugh at it either. And that laughter is a symptom of the general will. You laugh at those things that you share with other people because you share a common experience. So basically, the general will, as I interpret it and as other people interpret it, is that it's a sort of collective unconscious, if I can use Carl Jung's term. So that's the difference. The problem, however, is that the general will is not always expressed in democracy. But people in the modern world believe that the only way you can express the general will is through democracy.
So that's the tyranny of the majority.
Yeah. Yeah. Democracy is supposed to serve the general will, but what it instead does is it creates a sort of tyranny of the majority because it can't really serve the general will. The general will is far too complex and far too nebulous to be put into a political paradigm.
Benoit, he defines a liberal democracy has its goals sort of based on radical individualism as opposed to identities based on either ethnicity or race or religion.
Yeah, collectivism, basically. And the Benoit points out is that since democracy, as it was formulated by the French Revolution, is to serve the general will. But this general will is a collectivist idea. It's a collectivist concept. And liberalism is based around the idea of the individual. Including classical liberalism, is based around the idea that there is only the individual. And society is just composed of individuals. So when you have a society that's just composed of individuals, you no longer have a general will. You have a bunch of atomized people bouncing around and pursuing their common interests. So the Benoit points out that contradiction. On the one hand, you have radical individualism, and on the other, you have the general will. And they're sort of mixed together in modern democracy. And this isn't just a problem in the U.S. or in Europe. It happens all over the world. People take it for granted. They think that there's no contradiction, even though there is a contradiction. And the Benoit is pointing out those contradictions.
So you talk about salvaging democracy. And the last chapter of his book is Towards Organic Democracy. You're saying it's kind of a spoiler in case anyone wants to read the book, but it does talk about solutions. So he's not necessarily in favor of discarding democracy, but he does talk about what are some of his solutions. He talks about one of them being localism.
Yeah, he promotes localism because when you have localism, it's much easier to get a consensus. You go to a small town, you ask them about a particular topic, and it's much easier to reach a consensus. So it's so that's one of his ideas, localism. Another is referendum and plebiscites and qualitative procedures for measuring consensus. I'm not really sure what he means by the last part, qualitative procedures for measuring consensus, but plebiscites and referendums basically suggest that people should be consulted about a particular policy before it should be implemented. So it sounds good in paper, and politically minded Europeans, it can work on Europe because Europeans, from what I can tell, tend to be more politically active than Filipinos or Americans. So yes, it might work on France. The question is, can it work in other parts of the world?
And it definitely wouldn't work in the United States, where most people are I mean, it would take a population that's very, as you said, very active, a very civic minded and involved. And that's just not the case in the United States.
Or here. Yeah. So that's sort of my problem. You see, the Benoit approaches, from what I've read of the Benoit's essays, the only book I've read of him is the Deconstructing Democracies, but I read every essay I could find written by him. But and the problem with de Benoit is he tends to be too academic. He doesn't take into account the nasty, ugly parts of human politics. I like calling it politics.
You also say you don't think his style is Machiavellian enough.
Yeah. It needs to take into account human weaknesses. The Benoit's solutions are based on the premise that human beings are smart. They care about they're very civic minded. When in fact that's not really the case. A lot of people are very apolitical. That's one of the problems, I believe. I believe that one of the reasons why the Western world is having its problems right now is because its population is apolitical. I also believe that a lot of the problems here in the Philippines is the result of people not caring about politics or how their societies run. So there you go.
And so Benoit doesn't admit that factor or acknowledge it. He doesn't take it into account.
Yeah. And here in the Philippines, for example, I pointed out in the article that here in the Philippines, the three G's of Philippine elections is guns, gold, and goons. You use the gold to bribe people. If you can't bribe them, you use goons to intimidate them. And if you can't intimidate them, you use guns to kill them. So localism, referendums, and plebiscites sound nice and everything, but you can't use those on the three G's. And my response to de Benoit's attempt at salvaging democracy is to say that not all people are meant to have democracies. Some people are meant to be ruled by enlightened aristocracies. Some people are meant to be ruled by monarchies. Some people could sustain themselves in anarchy. not anarchy, but anarchism, the type of anarchy espoused by anarchism, you know, stuff like that. So,
yeah, those things, I mean, they're things that evolve over time to fit sort of the culture and geography of that area. The neoconservatives and neoliberals view democracy as something that can be exported.
Yeah, that
should be exported.
Yeah, that if you're not a democracy, there's something wrong with you. Well, you know what? There's nothing wrong with people who want to have an aristocracy. There's nothing wrong with people who want to have a hierarchy. People have been doing that for thousands of years, and the obsession with democracy is fairly recent. And Robert, this goes back to what I said about the traditional non-white culture being made obsolete. 100 years ago, non-white cultures consisted of monarchies, of tribal aristocracies, of tribal shamanisms and stuff like that. Today, we're all obsessed with democracy now. So you can see what my worldview based on that.
So the thing is, especially the people have to want, well, for democracy to work, the people have to want it.
Yeah, definitely. And they have to be willing to sacrifice certain things about it, and they have to basically conform themselves to a particular way. But I also pointed out in the article Deconstructing Democracy that there is no such thing as democracy, but there are only democracies, such that, you know, North Korea may be called a totalitarian state ruled by one guy, but from their perspective they have a valid democracy. Europeans may say a few bad things about American democracy, but from the perspective of Americans, American democracy is valid. It's very valid. And the same goes with all other democracies, even though the ancient Athenians would look at it and and say, no, that's not democracy, but, you know, that's how it is. Everything adapts.
Well, we can wrap it up now. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the topic?
No, but I would like to say hi to Greg Johnson. That's the guy of Countercurrents, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. All the readers of Countercurrents, hi from the Philippines. I don't agree with everything you have to say, but I believe that you're doing great work.
And your articles are mostly up on Alternative Right. Do you have your own website?
No. I used to have my own blog, but I shut it down. It was an attempt to create a sort of right-wing version of Encyclopedia Dramatica. It wasn't lulzy enough, so I took it down and decided to take my online political activism more seriously by submitting articles to Alt-Right.
I'd like to thank Sir Jaakko Akta for being on.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Salamat, bye-bye.